We go now in another area with Robert. Are you here, Robert?
Yes, here.
Perfect. Thank you very
Hello, can you
much.
hear me?
Yes,
Oh,
perfectly.
good.
You were a former associate professor at the Green National University. You are also a writer and also interested by notion like language and respect. I was very interested in your last articles. So because we are now already 12:27, you have time. We started later, so we will continue until 1:07. So 40 minutes for you, 20 for your presentation, and then the question. Please
Okay,
write
good.
the question in the chat so we have time to read them before. Thank you very much, Robert. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Let me see.
Can you share your screen?
I'd like to share my screen. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me to join the conference. What I'm going to talk about today is kind of a mixture of different things that have come together in my thought about language teaching in my career. And I'll just start by introducing the first, I'll talk about Cold War cosmopolitanism. And I'm also interested in the concept of cosmopolitanism because if any of you know about the political turmoil in the United States, which is ongoing, cosmopolitanism is now a very bad thing in the United States. It's considered a very negative thing. And I'm not sure if I agree with that personally, and how we look at cosmopolitanism as an attribute for people, as a goal for education, as something that people aspire to or don't like or disagree with. That is very important because language teaching and learning have had a long connection with cosmopolitanism. So I'm interested in that concept. That's very briefly what I will talk about, the outline. And then I will talk about legal support for the Cold War period, what went on in the Cold War period, and then academic and private sector support. And then that leads to the discussion about the native speaker, how the native speaker was placed in the efforts to promote language teaching as a way to promote solidarity during the Cold War. And then I will give several examples of teaching, how this is applied to the classroom or teaching exchanges, that kind of thing. And the idea of Cold War cosmopolitanism, I read this book on Korean film, has nothing to do with language. And I read this book on Korean film by Christina Klein. And in that book, she put forth this concept of Cold War cosmopolitanism. So I decided to apply it to language teaching. And it basically her conception of this is Cold War cosmopolitanism. Cosmopolitanism is best understood as a cultural formation that emerged alongside the expansion of US power into Asia after World War II. Of course, it could also be not just Asia, but other places as well. We can define it as a style, a set of textual and aesthetic properties whose production was stimulated by a body of institutions and practices. That's what I will be focusing on, and a set of material properties that were launched in accordance with a set of political and social ideas. I'll also be focusing on those, a set of intellectual properties. So my main focus will be on institutions and practices and political and social ideas that gave rise to the Cold War cosmopolitanism and how that influenced language teaching and policy. So legal support for the American Cold War cosmopolitan push, the first thing was September 1945. So that's just 1 month after the end of the war, World War II in the Pacific. And Senator William Fulbright introduced an amendment, Fulbright Act, to the Surplus Property Act of 1944. And the Surplus Property Act of 1944 was to sell extra war supplies as a way to make money and then give that money to help countries get back on their feet. Of course, the problem is, it didn't really work very well. I'll go into that in a minute. But the goal of Fulbright's amendment was the promotion of international goodwill through the exchange of students in fields of education, culture, and science. So what Fulbright wanted to do is use money for war redevelopment or war recovery. He wanted to use that money to fund education, culture, and science programs. And this became law in 1946, but it was difficult to implement because the countries didn't have enough money. Nobody could buy, it was hard for people to buy these extra leftover war supplies. So it kind of languished for a while. Until 1948, another wave came. This was the Smith-Mundt Act. And this gave Congress the ability to sort of a step up. And it was to promote better understanding of the United States and other countries and to increase mutual understanding between people of the United States and people of other countries. So this was taking a law that had applied to Latin America for cultural and educational exchange, and you applying that to other parts of the world. This was US government money directly given for that purpose, so different from the original Fulbright law. Next came, this was a big one, 1958, and you'll notice a gap between 1948 and 1958. Part of the reason for the gap was the McCarthy era and any dealings with trying to promote foreign languages, foreign exchange. Those were sort of considered, you might be a communist or a circumspect. And so there was a little bit of a slowdown in the early 1950s, but it picked up later in that decade. And a very important law for funding foreign language education and cultural exchanges was the National Defense Act of 1958. And this was the idea that not enough Americans knew science, math, and foreign languages. So they needed the domestic US foreign language education needed to be supported. And this also gave money for funding area studies programs. And many area studies programs, say Chinese studies, Japanese studies, Latin American studies, European studies, these area studies programs were funded at universities. And that also created the need to teach languages of the places that were being studied. So a lot of money was given to universities and to students to study languages. Then the Peace Corps Act, and this really was also, again, the same flow, the same idea of building this rapport with the world. And so you have the Peace Corps Act. The Peace Corps Act was to. Oops, sorry again. Okay. The Peace Corps Act was to, again, this idea that if you promote exchange, that will help the world understand the United States, and then the United States will understand the world, this sort of mutual thing. But it was, again, another piece of the flow towards promoting cultural exchange. And a very important act, the Fulbright-Hayes Act, this was building on the first Fulbright Act and combining all of the things that I've said before, except for the Peace Corps Act. It's combining all of these different programs and exchanges into a much bigger bill, much bigger law with greater funding. And it was to assist the development of friendly and sympathetic, that's a key word. So it was to assist in the development of friendly, sympathetic, and peaceful relations between the United States and other countries of the world. After this, the Fulbright program grew to be much bigger. And of course, many scholars, Fulbright scholars from overseas came to the United States, and Americans were funded to go overseas. So after 1961, the Fulbright program grew and became a very important piece of the overall policy of educational exchange and foreign language education. And academic support happened around the same time, and there was quite a bit of interaction between the two, academic and the government and the academic world. There was also a great deal of separation and sort of tension between the two. I just mentioned the McCarthy era. That created a period of tension where academics were fearing for academic freedom. They were afraid that they would be accused of being a communist and fired from the universities. So actually in the US, the idea of 10-year lifetime employment in a university, a lot of that came about as a response to the McCarthy era. But at the same time, there was also cooperation between academics and what was going on at the government level. And Charles Freese was an interesting case because he is considered one of the founders of the audiolingual method or the Army method. And he is known for that, but he was also very interested in this idea of culture and culture exchange. And so a quote from his 1945 book, which really codified the audiolingual method, a thorough mastery of a language for practical communication with real understanding demands a systematic observation and recording of many features of the precise situations in which the varied sentences are used. Such a systematic observation and recording must be minute and sympathetic, not for the purpose of evaluation in terms of one's own practices or of finding the quaint customs, but in order to understand and to feel and to experience as fully as possible. So this is the idea that, seeing a dance performance or eating food or this kind of thing, that's not really what the goal of cultural education should be. Cultural education, cultural exchange should be for deepening an understanding of the language, to feel the language and to experience it as fully as possible. So Freese was already supporting the idea that language and culture should be closely connected. And this, of course, relates to the audiolingual idea of the goal of audiolingual is to produce produce speakers who are native-like competence. And so Freese was naturally interested in applying this to the cultural aspect of language, sociolinguistic aspects of language. Lotto was, Robert Lotto, also at the University of Michigan, was a student of Freese's, and he continued the development of the audiolingual method and had a large impact in Asia through the development of English language learning materials. And Lotto's take was quite similar. Language does not develop in a vacuum. A language is part of the culture of a people and the chief means by which members of a society communicate. A language, therefore, is a component of culture. So culture is above language. So you have language sort of as a below culture, which is an interesting framework that he's using, and a central network through which other components are expressed. So Lotto again emphasizes the importance of language. And of course, this deviates often from the image of audiolingual as repeating sentences. Often some of the sentences are nonsense. For example, am I a boy? Yes, you are. Whatever, that kind of grammatical, very narrow sentence pattern based approach, which is in the lower stages of an audiolingual course. But at the higher stages, there was this interest in creating sociolinguistic competence among learners. Then there's this study, National Commission for UNESCO and the State Department, a study done by Parker and these other organizations in 1957. And this was around the time Area Studies was being founded. A distinct and healthy trend in modern education and research has been the increased interdisciplinary study. The development of area studies during the last war gave this trend impetus. Many foreign language teachers have already had some experience in crossing departmental lines, and the teaching of cultural insights through language instruction is currently an avowed aim in some institutions. So before that, culture was not included, say before the Second World War, but after the Second World War, through the efforts of Fries and Lotto, language became a part of culture had a larger role in language instruction. And at the same time, there was private sector support, and this is kind of interesting because there were organizations that cooperated with the US government. Some of them, for example, there are rumors that the Ford Foundation had CIA people working for it. The Asia Foundation was originally founded in 1951. They say they're founded in 1954, but it was originally founded in 1951 as a CIA front to promote cultural exchange in Asia. And there are other youth exchange and many others. These are just some of the more common private sector groups that had close relationships with the US government and its initiatives. And of course, the US government, through the laws that I just introduced, was able to fund at various activities. Others like the Ford Foundation had their own money, but many of the other organizations relied mainly on US government money to fund their initiatives. So this brings us to the native speaker role. And Fries, in the same book, 1945, he brings up the native speaker. Our language is an essential part of every portion of our experience. It gets all the meaning from our experience, and it is in turn our tool to grasp and realize experience. Every language is thus inextricably bound up with the whole life experience of native users of that language. And this is important because the audiolingual method that Fries pioneered, the idea was native-like pronunciation, native-like the ability to produce accurate native-like sentences. The accuracy was important. So the goal was to mimic the native speaker, to follow the habits of native speakers. This is Fries applying that concept to culture. And what this does is it puts the native speaker in the position of being a kind of authority on culture, an authority. And of course, it's not saying that there are different types of native speakers, that there are immigrants, there are people who have different ideas, that native speakers, the idea is that natives are kind of a monolithic group, and that a representative, a single person from that group, is able to represent that group to talk about its values and experiences and culture and that kind of thing. So Fries is very early on, 1945, this is just at the end of the war, putting the native speaker as an authority on culture and how culture should be taught or interpreted. And Lotto follows the same kind of line again. We can define the goal in learning a foreign language as the ability to use it, understand its meanings and connotations in terms of the target language and culture. So again, this is hinting that the goal of teaching should be accommodating to target language cultural norms, and the ability to understand speech and writing of natives of the target language culture in terms of their meanings, as well as their great ideas and achievements. So culture isn't just studying high culture or that kind of thing, but culture is sort of feeling the daily life of the people who speak that language. And this definition excludes the necessity of learning to act native-like, and Lado is sort of covering himself, but it includes the need to understand what a native means when he says he acted in a particular way, and it includes the need to know what interpretation the native will make when he is told that someone acted in a particular way. So Lado is saying, we don't need to go native here, unquote. We don't need, there's that expectation is too high. But again, it's putting the native speaker in a central position as somebody who is an authority figure or a source of knowledge about the culture. And the culture, of course, culture is defined in very rigid, quite monolithic tones. And there are several interesting examples of how this period affected what was going on in schools, institutions. One is Kalamazoo College, and Kalamazoo College is a small college in Kalamazoo in Michigan. It's a liberal arts college, and it is a situation, Kalamazoo College developed a foreign language study program in the early 1960s, and what they did is their program was sending students abroad. And they developed this program in the 1960s, and they continued it all the way through. And at the time that this article about Kalamazoo College was published in the early 1980s, about 85% of the students went overseas to study. And of course, a key component for Kalamazoo College was the number one there, where it said to become acquainted in some depth with a culture, usually including the language. So again, we have this idea that culture is more important, perhaps, or culture is central, and language comes next. You can interpret that frame. A people and an educational system different from their own. So you have this idea of really the purpose of this foreign study program isn't language, it's more cultural exchange and learning another culture. And then there are the foreign language houses, which I did not live in one when I was a university student in the United States in the 1980s. I had several friends who did. And since this conference is in France, I remember one of my friends lived in the French house, and I went over to have dinner there. I studied Spanish, Japanese, and Korean, so my French was non-existent at the time. But I went over to the French house, and I remember being so shocked at how everybody was enjoying a dinner speaking French with very heavy American accents. It was one of the most memorable experiences, my undergraduate career, just being in surprise. So this, the language houses, instead of focusing on the language, they were more focused on culture, understanding, enjoying, trying to speak the language. And this is from a program at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, where they had these summer language houses for French, German, and Spanish. And again, the everything was conducted in the house, coffees, meals, the teaching, everything was done in the house. And it was to try to create this sort of Spanish-speaking space in the middle of Nebraska, and very intensive program. But the language houses are another attempt to try to bring in a strong cultural component into language teaching. And they have a native speaker. They have native speaker. All the language houses that I've seen, the ones that are still operating, state clearly that they have native speaker graduate students or native speaker advisors. So there's this idea that you have a native speaker, again, as a source of knowledge, a person of reference, that kind of thing. Finally, another example is sending English teachers to Asia. And this was the Asia Foundation. Again, as I just mentioned, it was founded in 1951 as sort of a front for the CIA and became independent, supposedly, in 1954. And in 1956, Asia Foundation was commenting on a program that for sending English teachers to Asia. In many areas of Asia, there is a strong desire for instruction in the English language. The foundation has become increasingly involved in helping meet this need. So they sent young graduate students to Japan to be drill masters, and they sent three English teachers to Korea. And this was the first program to send native speaker English teachers from the United States to Korea. Fulbright didn't get active until the early 1960s, so early mid 1960s. So this program started in 1955, and that was a big step forward for sending native speaker teachers to South Korea. And the other thing is, yes?
It's 25 minutes of presentation. I know it's almost the end, but I wanted
I will move on, yes. And very quickly, they had a, very quickly, the Lotto was involved in training the teachers with the Asia Foundation. So to quickly, very quickly close, language versus culture. There is, in this time, there was a tension between the two, but culture was, in most cases, cast as being above language. And that related to culture as a tool for projecting American influence broadly, the native speaker as an ambassador, a teacher, a resource person for culture. And then finally, language as a tool for enhancing national security, a narrower concept with the allies and client states. And this was the native speaker more as a linguistic resource. So sending a native speaker teacher overseas, that kind of thing. So I'll end there. I'm sorry to go over time, and we can take questions.
Thank you very much for bringing these dimensions.